Virginia. Thank Lynn and Bree. We're continuing in Matthew chapter 5, where Jesus is giving a new look at a lot of Old Testament law and concepts. And as Lynn read, but he started in verse 27, he began this teaching on adultery in that verse, and we will continue that this evening somewhat, looking at marriage. The first question is, what was the original Old Testament principle for marriage, divorce, and remarriage? And I show that Logan was the answered last, so Wes, would you like to answer this question?
Sure. So, in looking at my answer, I realized I sort of skipped the principle for marriage. Went straight to the divorce and remarriage part. So someone else can chime in with the Old Testament principle for marriage. But we read in Deuteronomy 24, there it is on the board. The first verse especially talks about the divorce. When a man takes a wife and marries her, and it happens that she finds no favor in his eyes because he has found some uncleanness in her, he writes her a certificate of divorce, puts it in her hand, and sends her out of his house. That's sort of the divorce part. And then we see what happens. She departs from his house, goes and becomes another man's wife. And then if the latter husband detests her, writes her a certificate of divorce, puts it in her hand, sends her out of his house, she gets divorced again. If the latter husband dies, who took her as a wife, former husband who divorced her must take her back to be his wife after she... must not take her back to be his wife after she has been defiled, for that's an abomination. So we have the divorce is this... sort of open-ended view of the husband. He has found some uncleanness. We don't have definition of what that involves. I looked into it a bit, found some other translations. ESV and New American Standard use, instead of some uncleanness, they use some indecency. The NIV uses something indecent. The International Standard Version and others use something objectionable, which is probably the most vague, something that the husband objects to. Apparently, the actual Hebrew means nakedness, which people then translate into shame. And so the idea here is there's something about the wife that the husband views as shameful, and that shame can be interpreted in pretty much any way the husband wants it to be interpreted, is what the scholars say. Interestingly, I thought Josephus, the historian, the Jewish historian that we often talk about, he writes of himself, about this time I put away my wife who had borne me 3 children, not being pleased with her manners. So that was enough. She had bad manners and she was divorced. And there's some debate. There are different schools of thought about what qualified as uncleanness. And even before what Jesus is going to solidify as the actual meaning of this principle, there were Jewish schools of thought that left it pretty open to whatever, and then there were others that said it's only adultery, even back under the Old Testament. And then the last thing, I found someone said the word, that we have this emphasis on writing a certificate of divorce, and it says puts it in her hand. This is like being served papers. Like, the person has to receive it. There has to be a written document, and the husband has to put it in the wife's hand. She has to know that he wrote that, and she has to see it. And I found this, this scholar said the word biblion in the Greek version is a written notice. It's a protection to the wife against an angry whim of the husband who might send her away with no paper to show for it. So this is possibly to keep the husband from getting mad and then spur of the moment saying, you're divorced. He has to write it out, and it's more formal. She has to receive it. She has to know what's happening. I'm not sure if that's speculation or not.
Yeah. I hadn't thought about the papers. I always assumed the papers was so that she could prove to whoever that she was divorced and not married. Who else would like to address? And I guess I missed the marriage part, too. I thought I was missing a lot when he said she had to go back here, too. That's not. Who else would like to address the principle for marriage, divorce, and remarriage? All right. Nobody else? Let's go on to Bill.
The marriage part, I happen to make a couple notes on that. Genesis chapter 2, verse 24, that a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. I dug around a little bit. Somebody pointed out this word join. It included the sense of permanent, of permanence. Divorce was not even a consideration, obviously, at this time. I think that's pretty significant. I liked what Mike Criswell wrote regarding these particular verses, that there was five conditions outlined in Deuteronomy 22 and Deuteronomy 24 possible fornication situation, and not one time is divorce ever a scriptural option. Now, forced to marry, forced to pay fines, and possibly death were some of the options with those five conditions that were outlined. Well, in Deuteronomy 22 and Numbers 5, forget Deuteronomy 24. But I thought it was kind of insightful. These situations that you would think would be bad, never was divorce one of the options. And that made kind of an impression on me. I appreciated that.
So your point is it was never a forced, a demanded option?
Yes.
Okay. Anybody else on question number one? Matt?
I think Bill's right when he says that, because everywhere in the Old Testament that we see the act of fornication or adultery or some sort of sexual sin, it is almost exclusively accompanied with the punishment of death. And we are not that far separated here from Deuteronomy 22, where we have things like rape and adultery and fornication being talked about there, and what the punishments there are for those sorts of sins. And Leviticus 18, we have the long list of the horrible sexual sins, and the punishment for all of those is death. And I know we talked about this when we talked about Mary and Joseph, but the punishment in the Old Testament for adultery and sexual sin was almost exclusively death, and it doesn't seem divorce is prevented here.
Thank you. I wonder how the two witnesses falls into that. Who else would like to address question number one? Mark.
Well, and that's, you make a good point with the two witnesses, because we have, I think it's, is it Leviticus 5, where a man suspects his wife of infidelity, and there is a process that he goes through. He brings it before the priest, and she undoes her long hair, lets down her hair, and then the priest writes the curses, and they take dust of the earth, and they put it in a bitter drink, and she drinks the, and so there's no death involved there. It's, it's debated what exactly it means that, the curse that comes upon her. So I think there are, as always in life, there are situations where there isn't a second witness. The husband suspects that the woman is guilty of adultery, but he doesn't know for sure. He didn't walk in on her. Somebody else hasn't walked in on her. And so this word in Deuteronomy, the uncleanness word, is nakedness, as you pointed out. And many times when it's used in the Old Testament, it's referring, you shall not see the nakedness of your so on, so on, so on. That's talking about sexual intercourse. And so I disagree with the position that this isn't talking about adultery. God hates divorce. Malachi says that he hates it. It's violence on the garment. I don't believe God's going to set up in the Mosaic Law a system whereby you can divorce your wife for burning the beans. That's not going to happen. So my interpretation of Deuteronomy 24 is that it is this situation that we're talking about. It is a situation where the husband suspects, is very highly suspicious, but he doesn't have the proof to put her to death. And so he is allowed. And so it's analogous to the New Testament situation. That's what Jesus is clarifying. And so then you had two groups of Jews. You had the Shammai group and the Hillel group. And the Shammai group said, no, it's sexual immorality of some sort, because that's what I'm sure they had teaching about it. God hates divorce, and so that's what it was. And then you had the Hillel group who said it's anything. You can make it anything. And I tend to agree with the Hillel group one, and that's why the Pharisees come to Jesus and ask this question. But I think the context of this, of the Mosaic law, is not God saying you can divorce your wife because she's ugly, or she smells bad now, she's not using deodorant. It's nakedness, it's you suspect. And I think, for me, that's all that fits in with the context of the Old Testament.
Just real briefly, really for those that are taking notes, Jeremiah 3, verse 1, talks about this this idea of one that has been divorced and then goes back after having been married to another. It says, they say, if a man put away his wife and she go from him to become another man's wife, shall he return unto her again? Shall not the land be greatly polluted? But thou hast played the harlot with many lovers, yet return again to me, saith the Lord. So there the Lord's comparing that, what he calls an abomination, something appalling, to what Israel did to him.
Anybody else? Question number two. What was the original rule concerning marriage according to Jesus in Matthew 19, 3 through 6? I don't know what point is that. It's something else. Austin, you'd like to answer this question.
So we have... tonight we're kind of talking about what we often refer to as the exception. And I'm strongly of the opinion that we wouldn't have nearly as many discussions about the exception if we focused more heavily on the rule and people were preaching, practicing, and living by what the rule actually is. And you have it right there. Where the Pharisees tempt Jesus later in Matthew 19. He answers, they ask him, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for just any reason? He answered, said, have you not read that he who made them at the beginning made them male and female? And he said, for this reason a man shall leave his father and mother, be joined to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. So then they are no longer two but one. Therefore what God has joined together, let not man separate. And as a side note to that, marriage isn't just a piece of paper. That's what the common sentiment is about it today, that basically you can live, you can shack up with whomever you like, and get all the benefits of marriage without having any real commitment to that, and that's fine. Marriage is okay, it's, you know, just an expensive piece of paper. That's not what the Bible says it is. It's something that God joins two souls into the oldest institution that he ever created. And even from creation, we can see it's something that should naturally be known by all, that marriage is between one man and one woman, and that it is a life union.
Right. Yeah, today it's, people get married so they can get insurance and Social Security. Who else would like to address this original rule concerning marriage? Well, Bill talked about it a little bit a minute ago. In Genesis 2, 21 and through 24, especially in verse 24, it says, therefore man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and they shall be one flesh. So the two are leaving their father and mother and they're being joined. And so this is a bond that is stronger than the parental bond, is what it's intended to be, it looks like from this. And as Bill mentioned, you know, there's some commentators that talk about what cleave means, that it's like a cement, a very strong glue, very strong bond. So that got me to thinking about bonding. Ecclesiastes 4, 9 through 12. Two are better than one because they have a good reward for their labor. For if they fall, one will lift up his companion, but woe to him who is alone when he falls, for he has no one to help him. Again, two lie down together, they will keep warm, but how can one be warm alone? Though one may be overpowered by another, two can withstand him, and a threefold cord is not quickly broken. So, there's a lot of different opinions, or at least two different opinions. Maybe Solomon's talking about teamwork here, but in the first part, it does seem like he's talking about marriage. So then what's the threefold cord? The one explanation, and if this is the two people being married with God, is the third bonding element. So if you think about a good bond always rips at the parent material, never at the adhesive layer. And so I also thought that if I were Solomon, how would I explain it? With gas metal arc welding. But it's a good analogy, because the two pieces of metal have to be cleaned at the weld. There has to be a lot of preparation for that. There is this bonding layer, which is somewhat like the oath. There is a shield of gas that keeps contaminants out. So, like the shield of faith. And if it's done cleanly and right, you can see the hands of the welder. So, anybody wants a good sermon analogy, there it is. Who else would like to address the original rule concerning marriage? All right, let's go on to question number three. How does the command that Jesus gave not only coexist within the law of Moses, but apply to us for all time? Read Matthew 19, 7 to 9. Bill, would you like to address this?
I'm still enjoying your welding analogy. I'll try. The sexual immorality mentioned by Jesus in Matthew chapter 19, verse 9, it is also covered. I feel like it's also covered by God and Moses in Deuteronomy 24, verse 4. Verse 4 describes this woman as defiled by that second husband who took her, but he later dies, and or he gives her a writing of divorce, certificate of divorce, and the idea that she can't go back to her first husband because she's been defiled by that second husband. In a similar way, in my mind, the party that is divorced unscripturally when remarried causes this other party to now become defiled, to be in fornication. And the party that's driving the divorce, driving this unscriptural divorce, is also guilty of causing adultery, both with their new partner and also the new partner of the one that's been divorced. So that's, I'm not doing as good a job as Bart did of bringing this from Old Testament to New Testament, but I think there's a connection there, and there's probably others that can explain it better than I have.
Who else would like to address this question of how this command Jesus gives coexists with the law of Moses and our current law as Christians? As Bill mentioned, there is, back to Deuteronomy, there is this idea that there was defilement connected with divorce. It was always, if adultery wasn't present, it was likely suspected. And then Bart also mentioned that this, he talked about Malachi. I think it's probably a good thing to just read that section. And this is the second thing you do. You cover the altar of the Lord with tears, with weeping and crying, so he does not regard the offering anymore. Now receive it with goodwill from your hands. You say, for what reason? Because the Lord has been a witness between you and the wife of your youth, with whom you have dealt treacherously. Yet she is your companion and your wife by covenant. But he did not make them, But did he not make them one, having a remnant of the Spirit? And why one? He seeks godly offspring. Therefore take heed to your spirit, and let none deal treacherously with the wife of his youth. For the Lord God of Israel says that he hates divorce. For it covers one's garment with violence, says the Lord of hosts. Therefore take heed to your spirit, that you do not deal treacherously. So it's that same idea of it's something that God hates, divorce. Anybody else on this question before we move on? Question number four. What is the one and only exception that one may divorce their spouse according to these verses in Matthew, according to these verses and Matthew 19:7? And what falls into this category? Hunter, would you like to address this question?
This is a very short answer. So sexual immorality being, of course, the reason, and what falls in the category, obviously adultery. That's all I got, but I'm sure there's maybe a little bit of other interplay going on.
Who else would like to address the question? Thank you, honey. Who else would like to address the question of what is the one and only exception, or what falls into this category? Awesome.
So, of course, fornication is sexual immorality, as Hunter said. Included in that is sins of homosexuality, bestiality, incest, pedophilia, and, of course, adultery. So this would be any sexual sin that would occur, I think, would fall under this category. That he's talking about here, fornication. I think we ruled out last week that sins like pornography would not fall into this category. I think it refers to the actual act involved itself and not just the thoughts or the thought process leading up to it. Also interesting, I think, and we can have some more discussion on this, but I didn't mention it in the questions, but you look back at 1 Corinthians 7. A lot of people will look at 1 Corinthians 7 and talk about if the unbelieving depart, then they're not under bondage in such case. Almost for some, opening up a second exception, where if they depart, then that's another exception for divorce. I don't have exactly the notes to get into it. Into that verse and a detailed study of that verse, but I don't think that qualifies as a second exception for divorce. I think there's one and only reason one can get divorced, and that would be if there is sexual immorality involved, as Jesus states.
Bart was talking about Wes's dad, Alan, has a good sermon on that on YouTube, and he covers that topic of 1 Corinthians. So pretty well. And there was an interesting thing that I had here in my notes that I think Bill talked about. Because I thought maybe this is what you were getting at in the last part of this question. What falls into this category of adultery? And in 5:32 it says, "But I say to you, whoever divorces his wife for any reason except for sexual immorality causes her to commit adultery," which that gives the idea that adultery may not be strictly a sexual sin, but it may be the damaging of the God-ordained covenant of marriage. Who else would like to address this question? Matt?
When we read this in English, we see the word "except for fornication." And the word "fornication" in American English does not mean what the Greek word porneia means. When people hear the word fornication, they think two unmarried people having these sorts of relations. That is not what this word means. This word is much broader, as we've discussed. And when we read that in English, and if we want to have an argument about English, it doesn't work here. So if somebody wants to say, well, this is only for fornication, these people would have had to have not been married when this happened, and then they got married and he found out or she found out. That's the general reasoning, is that like in the case of Joseph and Mary, they are not quite married. They are betrothed, and Joseph thinks that she has been unfaithful. Therefore, he has this right. But that's not what this word means. This word is not talking about fornication as we would see it. This word is, and Austin gave a whole bunch of examples as to what porneia would be, but it's not just that.
I had always, or at least I considered the betrothal part, that they were really considered married at that time. It's another debatable thing to talk about. Bill?
Yeah, I think I can help add a little bit to what Matt was just talking about, because I sit down with Blue Letter Bible and I had 15 different translations, and several of them I didn't even know what the letter stood for. But I'm looking at to Matt's point, three of them had fornication as the word there. Five of them had sexual immorality. Two of them had unfaithful. Two of them had immorality. One of them had unchastity. One of them had whoredom. And one of them had lewdness. So to Matt's point, this is much more than just fornication.
Right. Dennis.
I just looked it up in the dictionary. Any physical contact between individuals that involves the genitalia of at least one person.
All right. Who else would like to address the exception or the category? Okay, let's move on to question number 5. When a divorce occurs for a scriptural reason, which party can remarry and why? Dennis.
Well, I looked at Romans 7, 2 and 3, where the Bible clearly talks about a person who has lost a spouse to death and is permitted to remarry only in the Lord. 1 Corinthians 7:39 says that. Then 1 Corinthians 7:11, the Lord, through Paul, is addressing the necessity of keeping your marriage vows, and he talks about a scenario of one spouse departing or leaving the relationship, not necessarily addressing the qualifying reason of sexual infidelity, but everything else. And I think involved in this also could be one spouse is a Christian, the other spouse is not. That's one scenario that seems to be implied here in verses 12 through 16 of 1 Corinthians 7, that the leaving is brought about because of a leaving spouse in this particular passage, but not to divorce, but they are to. But I thought the one who left very likely at some point will engage in sexual relations with another person, and then at that point would they be qualified because they're considered married, that one leaves and becomes sexually active with someone else, now they have become, they have committed adultery with their spouse. So the short answer is I believe that the innocent party can remarry. The one who brought about the problem in the first place, their actions, can't, because that would be completely inconsistent, illogical. I want out of this marriage, so I'm going to go do this, so I can have it. It's like, I want to go engage in these sins, but tomorrow I'm going to show up at the church building and get baptized again. I did it last week, I'm going to do it this week too. So.
Okay. Thank you. Who else would like to address which party can remarry when a divorce occurs for a scriptural reason? Scratching your nose, raising your hand.
Both. Austin used the word earlier, institution. You know, we've heard that a lot of times over the years, the institution of marriage. And so, what's institution? What's that look like? Well, foundation, an establishment that is devoted to a particular cause, a structure or a mechanism of social order and cooperation governing the behavior of individuals. And that, to me, that's what marriage is. It fits in my mind. And through these verses in this study, I found myself trying to understand a position that Matt's pretty familiar with, you know. And if we're not careful, that no divorce, and we've talked, Matt and I have talked about it, you know, that no divorce position makes the innocent party a victim of an institution that the Lord created for the help and the enjoyment of the two spouse, the husband and wife. And so that, you know, it's hard for me to wrap my mind around that, but Matt's got he pointed out an example of a man that truly stayed, you know, true to that with his wife leaving. And so, you know, you gotta respect that, but I struggle with that position.
Thank you. We also like your address. Which part you can remarry and why? Awesome.
It's a little bit less on this question. I do believe that it's only the innocent party, if you will. And you know, even when you're talking about divorce, of course I'm not married, but I know enough about confrontations and disagreements between people to know that generally when things like this happen, there's no one person that's completely innocent. But I think when we refer to innocent party, we're talking about the one who didn't commit the specific sin. But I think it's worth mentioning, worth noting, that just because something like this does happen, these passages don't necessitate that divorce has to happen. And furthermore, it doesn't necessitate that one has to be married again in the Lord, even if divorce does take place. Once again, I said it before, I'll say it again, going back to following after the rule instead of going and looking and hunting for the exception, waiting. So there's some people that are waiting for the exception to happen because of where they're at, and I've, you know, seen and heard about that in times past. But it's not an absolute that divorce has to take place, because God does hate divorce, and there's ways to, I would think, between husband and wife, try to get around that and repair that relationship.
Anybody else on this question? Matt.
Jesus uses the husband as the example of the faithful spouse and the wife as the example of the unfaithful spouse. That does not necessarily mean that that's the only way that this can go down. Jesus uses gendered language throughout all of his sermons, and especially through this one. He says earlier, if your brother does this, if your brother does this, if you are angry with your brother, well, that doesn't just mean if you're angry with your brother. It could mean if you're angry with your sister, or if your sister is angry with you. That the specific language that Jesus uses here is not saying that the only way that this can go down is if a wife is unfaithful to her husband. The inverse works as well. He just doesn't spell it out here because it seems obvious with the rest of the passage to take the logic of what he's using here. But the argument that there is only one scenario here, and that's that the husband is faithful and the wife is unfaithful, is not what Jesus is getting at here.
All right. Very good. Thank you. Yeah, I hadn't thought about the gender portion of it. I wonder if that has to do with back to Deuteronomy, where the husband gives out the certificate. Anybody else on this question?
Matt. Just add real quick that that's where the argument comes from, is from Deuteronomy 24. If someone's saying that Jesus is clarifying Deuteronomy 24, that the only way that this can happen is when the wife is unfaithful. That's what Jesus is saying here. But it doesn't. I don't think that's what he's saying.
Dennis mentioned 1 Corinthians 7 and the unbelievers, a believer married to an unbeliever and so forth. If you get the chance, go and watch that YouTube video. And Alan gets into when the marriage is ended, when the divorce takes place versus when other people remarry and so forth. It's a good exposition on 1 Corinthians. So. Let's go on to question number 6. Why has this issue been the cause of division in the church? Lance, would you like to answer this question?
Sure. I think for many reasons it causes a division because there's a lot of emotions involved and there's a lot of people that you know personally involved, and then you're also looking to other people to help solve those problems. So that's a big issue there. Also, you run into he said, she said kind of things, so situations. I think mainly it's getting at the no exceptions, where people, you know, of the church believe there's no reason that you can get divorced and remarried. And, you know, obviously I think we see in this chapter and also in Matthew 19:9, talking about, the exception to sexual immorality there. So I think that's some of the main divisions there.
Thank you. Who else would like to address this? Why has this become a cause of division within the church? Dennis.
I was thinking, nothing really changes. I think it's from the hardness of the individual's hearts, collectively. And I was thinking about James chapter 4, where wars and fights come from among you, do they not come from your desires for pleasure that war in your members? You lust and you do not have, you murder, you do not obtain, you fight a war that you do not have because you do not ask. Basically, you ask amiss, which you may spend on your wrong pleasures. And he follows up with two words, adulterers and adulteresses. You know, and I think it's a hard issue individually. And I think it's people wanting the Bible to say something that doesn't.
Thank you. Who else would like to address this question? Matt.
When we seek the truth, we will butt heads on some conclusion that we come to. If you don't believe that, listen to any of the recordings that we have in this building on Wednesday night. How we handle the disagreements is what will determine the future of the church. And in the past, men of great conviction have not handled these well. And their pursuit was noble. I wasn't alive, but you want the truth. And what happens is people get so focused on being correct that they don't care about the other Christian virtues that go along with discussion of doctrine and moral matters. And when you get into those discussions and if this congregation is any example of how to disagree very seriously about something and continue to meet in the same building and continue to push forward, then I think if people had thought that way 50, 60 years ago, that this might have turned out differently than it has now. Of course, you can't fix what happened in the past, but we can fix the way that we think about issues and the way that we handle them. And we're much more likely to isolate into groups of people that we agree with. And when we do that, there's a whole bunch of psychological and sociological implications of getting into groups and fighting with one another. You tend to see the other group as much worse than they actually are. But these are all things that have happened, and if we can see those things happening before they happen, then maybe we can disagree better. And that's really what it comes down to, is we have to learn how to disagree better as a church. It's not just about this issue, it's about a lot of issues. We have to learn that study and patience and love is far better than division is in most every scenario.
Very good, thank you. Who else would like to address this question? Bill.
I got one last point to make, and I appreciate the points that Matt made and the focus. I looked at it a little bigger, or from a wider lens. This whole marriage and divorce thing, it's a societal problem. It's typically the problems that are in society are eventually they work their way into the church. You know, we've seen it. Folks have seen it a lot longer than I've been alive. They eventually get into the church, but think about us as the church. One role that the church has is to reach the lost, the people of society, and guess what? You know, people outside, we all have issues, but people outside the church, they have issues. And when people try to come into the church, and we need to do our best to bring them to Jesus, to bring them to God, to bring them to the truth, to help them see what God wants them to be, how God wants them to live, how God wants them to change their lives. And so you pull all that together, and it's tough. You know, it's hard to work those kind of issues. And so that's our challenge. I think it's something that we need to try to embrace. And that's what we're going to have to do, if we're going to grow the church.
Anyone else? Well, I didn't understand the theological arguments behind it, so I again turned to YouTube, watched George Batty this time, I think, and so he kind of gave the two different sides. This was in a debate, I believe. So if we can discuss this afterwards, but this is what I understood. The one position of at least what George said was that Moses' law allowed for divorce, and he was trying to, that it was for more than just, that uncleanness was more than just adultery or fornication, that it was kind of like the Hillel, that it was more broad, and that was Old Testament law, and New Testament law is different from that. I think, and then the no exception position, the way he explained it was that Moses allowed for divorce only for fornication and uncleanness, which I think I agree with Bart, that seems to be the way it reads in Deuteronomy 24:1. And that itself is the true law for marriage from the beginning was there was no divorce, and that seems to be the case. So, and as we've all talked, that the original intent was for divorce not to take place, but that this one exception has seemed to have always existed through the Old Testament law, and this is a clarification by Jesus, and that from the beginning, that exception was put out there because of sin. If there was no sin, we wouldn't need this exception for divorce. Bart?
And I like the way you said that, because you could say hardness of your hearts, you could substitute sin there. I'm not saying actually in the actual Greek, but I think that's the idea. We tend to look at hardness of the hearts, or at least I have in the past, as we're giving you this liberal rule because it makes you cranky otherwise. But really, looking at what you just said, he's saying Moses, because of sin, because of the fact that people commit adultery and fornication, permits divorce. Not because, you know, you're a bunch of cranky Israelites. It's because of the fact that there was, the hardness of the heart is violating your marriage covenant. And then God allows an exception because there's sin.
Yes.
I think this is an example of that, go along with what Bart was saying. I think living in a culture that we do, but we kind of get desensitized to how vitally important this institution of marriage is, because as we all know, it's a picture of Christ and the church. Now, what Jared and I saw, that God actually divorced his people a few times. Jeremiah 3:69, he says, have you not seen what the faithless Israel did? She went up on every high place, or every high hill, and under every green tree, and she was a harlot there. And I saw that for all the adulteries of the faithless Israel, I had sent her away and given her a writ of divorce.
Okay. Well, we're 5 minutes over. End for this evening.